to our listeners and viewers, and thank you for joining this episode of the INSS podcast series. My name is Michal Chatuel-Radoshitsky. I'm a research fellow at INSS. And this episode is recorded close to International Holocaust Remembrance Day on January 27th, and further to recent developments in the United States, particularly on January 6th, the day Congress certified Joe Biden as president-elect, and right-wing extremists invaded the American Capitol. I'm linking the two events because it was reported that among those who stormed Capitol Hill were neo-Nazis and white supremacists. Now, at INSS, we have a team of researchers, and I'm fortunate enough to be among them, who are engaged and have been for the last year or so in a comprehensive research project looking at contemporary anti-Semitism in the United States. In the coming weeks and months and throughout 2021, we will publish a series of articles relating to this subject. Now, some of those articles are written by the INSS research team and others by outside top-notch American and Israeli experts with ample experience and knowledge on the specified issues. One of them is with us here today, and I'm honored to welcome Dr. Heidi Beirich, co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, whose article about right-wing anti-Semitism in the United States will be published on our website very soon. Heidi, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for giving me the opportunity also to write something for you all. It's very nice.
So Heidi, let's start with recent events on Capitol Hill. Who was there? What do they stand for? And how do their grievances, if I understand correctly, that the Democrats stole the elections, how does that circle back to anti-Semitism and Jews?
There were quite a few factions of the extreme right that were involved in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th. Among them were open white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups. So in the case of those two factions of the far right, or the very far right, Jews are at the heart of their beliefs. Anti-Semitism is essentially a core belief of these movements in the United States. They are also very much against other populations, immigrants, Muslims, etc. But at the end of the day, what they really care about Jews, and they believe in the traditional conspiracies about Jews that have been around for far too long. Jews are manipulating politics, finance, etc. The other part of the factions who were there on Capitol Hill are this conspiracy movement called QAnon. And QAnon believes an insane thing that Democrats are working with Satanists to child sex traffic. I know it just sounds completely bizarre, but the QAnon movement, which is actually quite large, probably a couple million people, also is anti-Semitic. In other words, Jews are the ones pulling the strings now behind the Democrats, behind all these terrible things that they believe are happening. So anti-Semitism was coursing through the people who stormed the Capitol and led this insurrection. You know, you asked the question about their motives and why they were there and how it connects to anti-Semitism. Well, the ostensible reason that these folks and others, you know, Trump supporters and so on, went in there was to stop the finalization of the count that would have, you know, that would affirm that Joe Biden is the president-elect. The fact that we see these kinds of Nazis and white supremacists at something that was really about believing that, you know, we'd had an illegal vote is because these same types of groups do not believe in this democratic system. They don't believe in our institutions. They don't believe that we have free and fair elections and that the people vote. They believe in conspiracies, including conspiracies about Jews.
This seems to me, your last answer about conspiracies about Jews, it's like the most ancient thing I can think about. And I'm really wondering if we try to zoom out of Capitol Hill for a second and look at America, you know, in the last few years, maybe let's even look at the Trump presidency. Do you see that their situation has changed? Because you just mentioned, I hope I'm saying this right, QAnon, right? It's quite a recent phenomenon. It's quite a recent, there's this uprising of this group and more people are involved in it. So essentially my question is, what's changed maybe in 2020, but also more broadly in the last few years?
Well, the United States has experienced a huge upsurge in white supremacist and neo-Nazi, that kind of extremist activity. The beginnings of that growth can be traced actually to when Obama came into office. That was when the number of hate groups grew in the United States. And perhaps more importantly, it was when totally unregulated social media existed. And these organizations harnessed Facebook, Twitter, and other places to build their movements. And one of the key aspects of their messaging has always been these ridiculous ancient Jewish conspiracies. So the ranks of anti-Semites in the US have been going up since, you know, around 2008, 2009. But it was greatly accelerated with Trump coming into office. People don't realize this, but the last campaign ad that Trump ran depicted sort of Hillary Clinton, the Jewish philanthropist George Soros, and others as being part of some kind of New World Order cabal. You know, Jews are often attached to that as well, right? They're running some sort of secret New World Order in league with the United Nations and globalist bankers. You know, there's various versions of this. That was his last ad. And so the way that white supremacists and extremists identified with Trump and the way he sort of played back to them the messages they wanted to hear meant that they were growing in their ranks as well. The messaging was spreading. Social media was still unregulated, basically until the Charlottesville white riots in August of 2017. At the same time all this was happening was the rise of QAnon. There was no QAnon 4 years ago. It's an amazing phenomenon that in just a few short years, millions of people could be attracted to a completely insane conspiracy theory that has anti-Semitism at its roots and build a movement that would eventually lead in 2020 to the storming of the Capitol and also the election of two congresswomen, one from here in Georgia where I am and another from Colorado, who are QAnon supporters or adherents. This could never have happened before the era of social media. And I should say that Trump has retweeted and tweeted out QAnon material more than a few hundred times over the course of the last few years, plus sort of his acolyte.
Knowingly, do you think, or are all these things like coded? I was looking at, like, I was trying to read some of the stuff and I saw all these, I don't know, definitions that I think to most of us, they don't really say much. So that's why maybe he was retweeting things that he wasn't aware of.
Well, I mean, it's always possible with Trump that he wasn't quite aware of what he was doing. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, that one might be an excuse for doing it once or twice or five times, maybe, or maybe even 10 times, but not for hundreds of times. It was a tactic. People with QAnon slogans, hats, clothing started showing up at Trump rallies, and the campaign certainly wanted to harness that support going forward. So at some point, I just don't feel like I can, you know, give him a pass or his allies a pass. I mean, his sons did the same thing. They knew what they were activating. They knew who they were reaching out to, and they knew that it made up part of that base. So here we sit at 2020 after all this, with probably more people, you know, radicalized into anti-Semitism than we had 4 years ago, certainly 10 years ago as well, unfortunately.
So one of the things you mentioned that caught my ear is the social media issue, right, or the digital realm. And you say that when Obama was elected, it was unregulated. Is that to say that now we can trust the social media platforms more not to share vile anti-Semitic content?
We can trust them more. That doesn't mean we can trust them fully. What I meant by that is before the Charlottesville riots happened, you know, and an anti-racist activist, Heather Heyer, was murdered by a white supremacist. Before that time, the terms of service on social media sites, even if they sort of banned, you know, hateful content or had other things in there, there was no content moderation going on. Financial services outfits like PayPal that do online transactions let anybody use their services. I mean, I personally was involved in begging PayPal in the pre-2017 era to stop allowing, for example, Klan groups to use PayPal. So the material was proliferating. It was everywhere. It was on every single site, whether it was like a place like Reddit or it was a Facebook. Now, what happened after Charlottesville is the crackdown, the deplatforming began, but it was very uneven. So some very prominent people, you know, prominent white supremacists did lose their social media accounts right after Charlottesville, but it was very uneven. And frankly, it took until this past fall, I'm just going to use Facebook as one example, for all anti-government militia groups, groups that call for civil war in this country, to be deplatformed. QAnon wasn't deplatformed until very close to when the election happened. And the same kind of thing can be said about Twitter and other sites. So it's
just
taking-
explain one sec, what do you mean when you say deplatformed? That they're not allowed to have to post on Facebook or?
Yes, their entire structure of posts, comments, whatever is taken down and they're no longer allowed to put material up, period. In other words, you're banned from social media.
Okay, so this begs the following question, and I'm really sorry to be the devil's advocate, and I probably don't have a better suggestion, but for what it's worth, isn't this just going to move all their traffic to the dark web where we can't monitor it? We don't know what's happening with them. I mean, it's not like you can press a button and they're going to go away.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have a point, right? This is definitely driving these folks to other places like Gab and Parler and Telegram, right? It doesn't mean the end of these movements. But what I think is really important to remember is when you deplatform groups from the mainstream sites, they can no longer recruit. They cannot build their ranks. They can't radicalize people in the way that they have in the past. And the best example for looking at this is how ISIS was deplatformed. It disrupted their networks when they were thrown off of Twitter in particular. It reduced the amount of postings that we found online. It made recruitment harder. And we're now seeing the same pattern play out with neo-Nazis and white supremacists, similar extremists. Now, that said, they're still going to be over there at Telegram, and they're still going to have a lot of people following them because they built their ranks up over the last, you know, 5-10 years. So, and we will actually still be able to monitor them, because Telegram is relatively open, VK is relatively open. But even if we couldn't, even if it was much more difficult to monitor these folks, it's more important, in my opinion, that they not be able to add to their numbers.
Yeah, okay, so you have a point, because it does marginalize them, definitely, I understand that. My next question, let's circle back to QAnon and maybe others, but I don't know if this is true, but is QAnon very specific to the American right-wing or super right-wing or radical right-wing extremist scene, or can you also find them elsewhere? That's particularly regarding QAnon, but also other right-wing extremists. Do you see them in the United States liaise with other right-wing extremists in Europe and elsewhere, or are their struggles very contextualized, particularized to the setting that they're in?
It's a very important question. You would think that QAnon, with this very specific concern about the Democratic Party in this country being involved in child sex trafficking in this country, would not be something that could be exported from the United States, but you would be sorely wrong. QAnon has actually spread to the UK, to Germany, to France, probably other places. QAnon adherents, people with QAnon hats and clothing on, were actually involved a few months ago in the attempt to storm the Bundestag in Germany. They were one part of the factions who were there. So it's spreading like a virus into other places. It's also true, if we look at just white supremacy writ large, this is no longer a domestic movement, right? This isn't an American problem and a Canadian problem and a German problem where this movement is reacting to specific events within a particular domestic context. This is a transnational alliance where all these people work together. They all basically believe the same ideas at this point. In other words, they believe that white people are being genocided or displaced from their historic homelands and that something needs to be done about that. And most of the domestic terrorist attacks we've had, for example, the Christchurch attack, the Hall of Germany attack, the Pittsburgh synagogue attack here in the United States, every one of those shooters from all those different places in the world believed the same thing, which is that white people were being genocided and somebody needed to do something about it. And oftentimes it's Jews who are blamed, and hence targeting of places like synagogues. So we don't, these aren't domestic issues anymore. These ideas span borders, organize across borders, chapters across borders. I mean, you can't look at this through a domestic lens. It's part of the reason why I started this new organization, is to look at these issues transnationally.
So I'm just thinking back about our last question. So deplatforming these guys off, you know, the mainstream websites or social media websites is important as far as marginalizing them is concerned, but it's not going to be able to limit their interactions with one another globally. So we need to think of something else for that, I suppose.
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to ask you, this is one of the things that I came across in reading the summary of the conversation we had with you in one of our learning sessions with you. I want to ask you about the response now, about, you know, what is really being done in the United States regarding these guys. And the piece of data that I wanted to refer to is that you mentioned that the FBI knows of about 6,000 hate crimes, whereas in actual fact, the estimate is that there are more than 200,000 hate crimes. So this really begs the question, you know, what's happening there, and what is the response to this right-wing extremism?
Well, the response for the last 4 years, and actually I could say going back to the Obama administration, at least until the very end of the Obama administration, has been very little. That's been changing in the last year, when we've seen every big federal agency, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the National Counterterrorism Center, all have gone on record to say white supremacy is the most important problem. And now we have an administration, right, who will be coming into office today, Biden, who has made very clear that he's going to tackle this issue. His first campaign ad was about Charlottesville, actually, and about the horrors of white supremacy in Charlottesville. So there's going to be a lot on the table coming now. You know, among the things that I expect to see is that the US military will finally start rooting extremists out of its ranks. You know, there were quite a few veterans and active duty service members who were at the Capitol the other day storming it. And the military has a problem on its hands that it knows about and has done nothing about. So that's one thing that's going to happen. You brought up the hate crimes issue. Why is it that we don't report 90% of the hate crimes in this country? I mean, given the data we have, we don't even know who's most victimized, right? If you're only looking at 10% of data, you don't really know what the patterns are. The Biden administration has said that they're going to make hate crimes a priority for the Department of Justice to prosecute. And they're going to look at how hate crimes data reporting happens. And hopefully we're going to get some movement on fixing that. The other thing that's going to happen, I expect, I mean, I can't be sure, is that the FBI is going to reprioritize and shift resources so that they are dealing with the kind of threat we get from anti-Semites and neo-Nazis and white supremacists in the way they're dealing with Islamic extremism. We, of course, face both threats at the same time. So we're going to find out more about that. There's also going to be hearings on Capitol Hill about things like the online space and what is happening there, and why are extremists able to access those places, and what do we do about it? You know, all these issues are going to be on the table, and I expect to see policy change. It may be that in the United States, we change a particular part of our law called Section 230, which exempts social media companies for responsibility of what's posted on their platforms. That might be tweaked and changed. So all of these things are about to come about, and we're probably going to see a completely different agenda in which the administration puts its full weight behind trying to deal with this threat. And I didn't even mention all the domestic terrorism that we've had, you know, mass attacks like at the El Paso Walmart. I mentioned the Pittsburgh synagogue attack, but there was another one in Poway, California, the synagogue. There's been a lot of that, and that has going to have to be a major focus of the administration. I'll just add one more thing. They're going to have to work across borders. They're going to have to work with intelligence agencies and law enforcement officials in Europe in particular, but other countries, because these things don't exist in one place anymore.
I also think probably the rhetoric will change. And maybe that will also play a factor.
I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because that one thing may be more important than anything else. We will not have somebody in the White House using the bully pulpit, as we call it here, to push extremist ideas. We will have someone saying those ideas are bad and unacceptable. And I think that will have a major calming effect, right? And it will kind of write us to where will make sure that what is extreme stays on the fringes and is no more part of mainstream society. So I got to tell you, I'm really looking forward to that aspect of this political change.
And just to end off, because you spoke a lot about the institutional aspect of what we may see in the next few years, vis-a-vis the response to right-wing anti-Semitism and extremism in general. But what about the role of civil society? You know, particularly you mentioned that you established a center monitoring or tracking these kind of things. So where does civil society come in, again, kind of forward-looking?
Well, I think the last 4 years, if we hadn't had really good civil society organizations in this country dealing with this issue, you know, my former employers at the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Anti-Defamation League, others, the ACLU filing lawsuits against bigoted policies. I mean, I could go on and on and on about really great institutions that held this administration to account and kept this in the public domain. And the same is going to have to be so going forward. So the civil rights community needs to speak up on these issues, keep pushing on these issues, work with the administration to craft smart policies to stop this. And, you know, one of the other reasons I created this new organization was also to uplift smaller civil society organizations in other countries that may not have the capacity or the ability to, you know, broadcast their concerns to the world. We need that kind of civil society everywhere, right, to protect people's rights. And so, you know, I feel like that's another major issue. And I hope, you know, the philanthropic community and individuals and whatnot will support institutions who are battling anti-Semitism and hatred and really want to rid our societies of these plagues. I mean, that's what they are. They're plagues.
Dr. Bayrich, thank you so much for your illuminating input on the extreme right-wing scene in the United States. And thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights with us. And thanks to you, our viewers and our listeners. For more INSS podcasts and interviews, follow us on our social media platforms, or you can log into the INSS website. Stay safe wherever you are.